Chapter 5. Using Land and Water. Muffled thunder surging from the sea. That gigantic white-laced wave is tumbling straight to me. From the poem, The Sea, by Charlotte Zolotow. Lesson 1. Focus. How does the geography of a region affect the way people live? Main idea. Read to find out how landforms and natural resources affect how people in New England live. Vocabulary. Glacier, quarry, tradition. The New England countryside. Most people in New England live in busy metropolitan areas near the Atlantic coast. Yet New England is also known for its quiet countryside. People travel from far away to visit its small towns, enjoy its colorful autumn leaves, and ski down its snowy mountainsides. The land. Inland from the Atlantic coast, New England is a region of broad valleys and rolling hills. Several low mountain ranges stretch across the region. They are part of the Appalachian Mountains. The Green Mountains of Vermont form New England's western boundary. To the east, in Maine and New Hampshire, lie the White Mountains. The Connecticut River flows between these mountain ranges. Thousands of years ago, the Earth's climate turned very cold. Glaciers covered much of the land. A glacier is a huge, slow-moving mass of ice. As the glaciers moved across the land, they wore down mountains and carried away fertile soil. After the glaciers had melted, many places in New England were left with poor, rocky soil. The soil was so rocky that early settlers had to clear away the stones before they could farm the land. They often used the stones to build walls around their fields. Today, New England is famous for its stone walls. Stonewall, a poem by Ann Turner, tells about them. A line across the field, a mound of rising snow, a hiding place of nuts and chipmunk in his hole, built with horse and arm to keep the cows from harm, and now it keeps the field locked tight and me inside its bounds. Review. What kind of soil covers much of New England? New England farms. Many crops do not grow well in New England's poor, rocky soil and cool climate. However, agriculture is important in every New England state. New England farmers simply raise the crops and animals that do well there. Does your family eat cranberries at Thanksgiving? The cranberries may have come from Massachusetts, a leading cranberry grower. Maine is famous for its potatoes. Other leading crops grown in New England are blueberries, apples, corn, and oats. Pasture grasses also grow well in New England's cool climate. Many farmers raise dairy cattle on those thick green grasses. Their farms are just a short drive from the large cities along the coast, where a lot of milk, butter, and cheese is sold. Review. Why do New England farmers raise only certain crops? Other resources. New England farmers have learned how to farm well even with their poor, rocky soil. Some New Englanders, however, make their living from rocks. Both New Hampshire and Vermont have a lot of marble, granite, and other kinds of stone used in buildings. In fact, Vermont has the largest granite quarries in the nation. A quarry is a large open pit cut into the ground to mine stone. Blocks of stone are cut from the sides of the quarry. Other people make their living from the forests that cover much of New England. Logging has always been an important industry in Maine. Wood cut from the state's many forests is used to make everything from lumber to paper products to toothpicks. Logging is an important industry in New Hampshire and Vermont, too. Another industry in New England also uses trees. Each spring, farmers and other workers take sap from sugar maple trees. Sap is the liquid that runs through the stems and roots of trees. The sap is boiled until most of the liquid is gone. What is left is sweet maple syrup, the kind that people put on pancakes. It takes more than 30 gallons, 114 liters of sap, to make 1 gallon, about 4 liters, of syrup. Review. Besides farming the land, how else do people use resources? New England towns. Among New England's farms and forests are many small towns. These towns and the smaller villages around them are often laid out in much the same way. Houses, stores, and other buildings are built around empty land in the center of the town. This empty land, called the common, was once used as a pasture for animals. Today, it is a park for people. In early New England, people made decisions about their town at town meetings. Town meetings were often held in a church called a meeting house, which stood at one end of the common. In Townsend, Vermont, and in many other New England towns, the tradition of holding town meetings goes on. A tradition is a way or an idea that has been handed down from the past. Important decisions in Townsend are still made at a town meeting held every March. The meeting, which is held at the town hall, is open to all the town citizens. A few hundred people usually attend. Review. How do many New England towns make decisions? Lesson 1 review. Check understanding. 1. Remember the facts. What are some crops that grow well in New England's poor, rocky soil and cool climate? 2. Recall the main idea. How do landforms and natural resources affect the way people in New England live? Think critically. 3. Cause and effect. How have glaciers affected the land in New England? 4. Personally speaking, what would you like most about a vacation in New England? Explain. Show what you know. Map activity. Draw a map showing what a typical town or village in New England might look like. Show the common, meeting house, homes, stores, and other buildings. Add a map key to your map. Reading and research skills. Tell fact from opinion. 1. Why learn this skill? Each day you get information from many sources, such as books, television, newspapers, and other people. Whenever you get information, you must decide whether it is true. You must ask yourself if it can be trusted. One thing that can help you do that is learning how to tell fact from opinion. A fact is a statement that can be checked and proved to be true. An opinion is a statement that tells what the person who makes it thinks or believes. It cannot be proved. 2. Understand the process. Snow falls in New England during the winter. This sentence states a fact. You could prove that fact true by visiting New England in the winter, by looking in books, or by talking to weather forecasters. To tell whether a statement is a fact, ask yourself these questions. If one or more of your answers is yes, the statement is probably a fact. Do I know this idea to be true from my own experience? Can the idea be proved true by testing? Is the idea from a book or another source I can trust? I think winter is the most beautiful time of the year in New England. This sentence gives someone's opinion. There is no way to prove what is the most beautiful time of the year in New England. A person who likes cold weather and snow may think New England is beautiful in the winter, but another person might like the summer more. An opinion tells what a speaker or writer believes. Looking for these clues can help you know when a statement is an opinion. Certain key words such as, I think, I believe, in my opinion, and I doubt, tell you that you are reading or hearing an opinion. Words such as beautiful, wonderful, terrific, and worst are often part of an opinion. Because no one can know the future, any statement about the future is an opinion. Sayings, old or new, also give opinions. My grandmother says you can never go to school too often because education helps make a good life. Opinions cannot be proved, but they can still be important. An opinion may be based on facts or experience. Thoughtful opinions can help people better understand the past or prepare for the future. 3. Think and apply. A newspaper is a good place to find facts and opinions. Look through several newspapers. Find at least 5 statements of fact and 5 statements of opinion. Use a crayon or marker of one color to underline each fact and use another color to underline each opinion. Lesson 2. Learn geography through literature. Lobster Boat by Brenda Z. Guyberson. Illustrated by Megan Lloyd. The rich fishing places that lie off the coast of New England brought many of the first Europeans to North America. Fishing is still an important industry in New England and in other coastal areas of the Northeast. the fishing industry provides not only food, but also jobs for thousands of workers. Workers are needed to pull the catch from the water and to unload the boats at the docks. Other workers get the catch ready for market and take it to supermarkets and restaurants around the country. Read now about one worker, Russ, and his nephew, Tommy, who work on a lobster boat named the Nellie Jean. As you read, think about why fishing is an important industry in the Northeast. Soon the fog burns off, and the bright blue-green of the ocean glistens in the sunlight. Scree, scree! More seagulls follow the Nellie Jean with noisy chatter. Russ lines up the boat with a distant white cliff to keep her headed in the right direction. Uncle Russ, Tommy shouts loud into the wind. Are we going to move the traps out into deeper water? Russ shakes his head. Not yet. Most of the lobsters seem to be moving across the gravel bottom right by the traps we put in last week. Russ squints across the bright ocean as he guides the boat. Soon they pass a group of painted buoys that are tied to lobster traps under the sea. The red and white ones belong to the Jensen brothers. Old Sam paints his buoys with orange stripes. Tommy grins when he sees the ones painted yellow on top and red on the bottom. Everyone knows that these belong to the lobster crew of the Nellie Jean. Throttle back, out of gear, Russ nudges the boat alongside their closest buoy. Tommy reaches out to hook the rope coming from the buoy. Russ slings it around the automatic winch and turns on the switch. Whirr! The winch grinds and groans, slowly pulling up a lobster trap that has been sitting on the gravel bottom 100 feet below the sea. The dripping rope brings water, seaweed, and a tiny crab into the boat. Scree, scree! Seagulls come so close that Tommy feels a wing flap against his shoulder. When the trap reaches the surface of the water, Tommy pulls it to the railing of the Nellie Jean. The trap is covered with furry sea growth and is slippery in his hands. Click, click. Reddish-black lobster claws reach out through the wires, and a pair of lobster antennas twitch in the salty sea air. Looks like we got ourselves a big one, says Russ. Tommy opens the back door of the trap and carefully grabs the lobster from behind. Click, click, go the crusher and ripper claws. Click, clack, click. Look at this female, says Tommy, loaded with eggs. Russ shows Tommy where to make a notch in her tail. No one will keep her now, he says, even when she isn't carrying eggs. Tommy puts the lobster back into the sea, where she will protect her eggs for months and months until they are ready to hatch. Tommy reaches in for another lobster. Too small, says Russ. Click, click, splash. Another lobster goes back into the sea. Tommy takes out the last one. Better measure it, says Russ. Tommy fits a brass gauge between the eye sockets and the end of the body shell. The lobster is 3.5 inches long and big enough to keep. Russ slips a thick rubber band over each claw. The lobster squirms and wriggles, but the claws do not open. This lobster goes into a bucket of seawater. Tommy takes the old bait from the trap and throws it into the air. Scree, scree, scree! Finally, the noisy seagulls get their breakfast. They swoop down and catch some of the soggy fish before it hits the water. Tommy uses the baiting iron to load new fish frames onto the bait string in the trap. I'll check the depth finder, says Russ. I don't want to drift away from that gravel bottom where all the lobsters seem to be traveling. Russ watches the gauge and pulls hard on the steering wheel to make a sharp turn. When he nods his head, Tommy pushes the freshly baited trap overboard. The lobstermen move on from trap to trap. They work quickly and check 20, then 50, then more than 100 traps. The buckets fill up with lobsters and seagulls fill up with old bait. They find 2 traps that are damaged and replace them with new ones. As the warm, sunny day turns blustery, Russ keeps a watchful eye on the darkening sky to the south. On the way to another trap, Russ gets a call on the radio. New weather report, says old Sam, who is fishing nearby. That squall has changed its mind and is headed right this way. Tommy looks over to see the dark clouds moving in fast. Both of them pull on yellow slickers and long oilcloth hats. Throttle full ahead, they start back to the harbor. The United States, like most countries that border the sea, claims ownership over all fishing within about 230 miles, 370 kilometers of its coast. To help conserve fish resources, laws say how many fish may be caught each year. Other laws tell which kinds of fish may be caught and the sizes they must be. Yet overfishing, along with increased pollution, is harming the future of the fishing industry in some areas. Literature review. 1. Why is fishing an important industry in the Northeast? 2. Why is it important for Tommy and his uncle not to keep small lobsters? 3. Draw a picture showing how a lobster trap might look at the bottom of the sea. Add sea life to your picture. Lesson 3. Focus. How can using resources lead to changes in a region? Main idea. Read to find out how the Middle Atlantic states have changed because of the ways that people have used resources. Vocabulary. Produce. Truck farm. Agricultural economy. Industrial economy. Finished product. Waterway. Competition. Old resources, new industries. The waters off the coast of New England were good places to fish, but settlers were sometimes unhappy about the poor, rocky soil they found on shore. In the Middle Atlantic states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Maryland, settlers found mostly rich soil. William Penn, who founded Pennsylvania, said the land in his colony was fast, fat earth. It was a place where farmers could do well. Rich farmland. As in much of New England, coastal areas in the Middle Atlantic states are crowded with cities. Many of those cities, such as New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore, are centers of trade, services, and manufacturing. Away from the cities, however, much of the land is used for farming. This land helps feed the millions of people who live in cities along the coast. Much of the land in the Middle Atlantic states is part of the coastal plain, the lowland that stretches along the Atlantic Ocean. Crops grow well in the coastal plain's rich, sandy soil. Produce, or fresh fruits and vegetables, grows very well. Produce must get from farms to stores quickly before it spoils, so produce is often grown on farms close to the cities where it is sold. Such farms are called truck farms because their produce can be taken by trucks to markets in nearby cities. Inland from the coastal plain is the Piedmont, another region with mostly fertile soil. The Piedmont's rolling hills and broad valleys stretch through parts of several Middle Atlantic states. The land in southeastern Pennsylvania is among the richest in the world. Because the land is so fertile, many farms there are small. A small field can produce a large crop of corn or wheat. A group of people called the Amish live in this part of the state of Pennsylvania. The Amish have an agricultural economy, or an economy in which people meet most of their needs by farming. The Amish raise their own food. They make most of the things they use. Because of their religious beliefs, the Amish live very simply. They do not use electricity or telephones in their homes, and they do not use cars or tractors. Instead, they use simple tools, such as plows pulled by horses. They travel by horse and buggy. Review. How is much of the land in the Middle Atlantic states different from the land in New England? New industries. In the early years of the United States, most people had to make or grow much of what they needed to live. One person wrote that a familiar sight in the 1700s was the American who, with the help of his wife and children, not only tilled his fields, but who also built his own dwelling, contrived his own tools, made his own shoes, and wove the coarse stuff of his own clothing. In fact, one leader described the early United States as a vast scene of household manufacturing. All that began to change in the 1800s. New cities and industries were springing up across the country. The United States was building an industrial economy, or an economy in which factories and machines manufacture most goods. The first factories were built along rivers, so that the rushing water could be used to run machines. Rivers also gave factories a way to ship their finished products to market. A finished product is a manufactured good made from raw materials. Over time, railroads were built and machines began to run on steam or electricity. Factories no longer had to be built next to rivers. Now they could be built nearer to the resources they used. Often, that was in the Appalachians. The Appalachian Mountains are rich in many of the resources that factories need. In the Middle Atlantic states, the Appalachians are made up of several smaller mountain ranges. There are the Allegheny Mountains in western Pennsylvania and Maryland, the Pocono Mountains in eastern Pennsylvania, and the Adirondack and Catskill Mountains in eastern New York. Review. How was the United States changing in the 1800s? Biography. Andrew Carnegie, 1835 to 1919. Andrew Carnegie was a leader in the steel industry. Carnegie came from Scotland to live in Pittsburgh when he was 13 years old. When he was a young man, Carnegie learned about a better way to make steel. In time, he became one of the richest people in the world. Carnegie gave much of his money to build libraries and schools. A center of industry. Many new industries started in the Middle Atlantic states. The steel industry, for example, began in western Pennsylvania, near Pittsburgh. Steel is made by heating iron, coal, and limestone. Western Pennsylvania and nearby areas in Ohio and West Virginia had all three resources. They also had an important waterway, the Ohio River. A waterway is a body of water that boats can use. In her book, No Star Nights, Anna Egan Smucker tells about growing up in Pittsburgh. We went to school across from the mill. The smokestacks towered above us, and the smoke billowed out in great puffy clouds of red, orange, and yellow, but mostly the color of rust. Everything, houses, hedges, old cars, was a rusty red color. Everything but the little bits of graphite, and they glinted like silver in the dust. As the United States grew, steel became more important. Railroad tracks, bridges, and many buildings and machines were built with steel. In the 1920s, the United States was making nearly three-fifths of the world's steel. About half of that was made in the mills of Pennsylvania. Review. Where in the United States did the steel industry begin? Changing industries. Steel mills in Pennsylvania no longer make as much steel as they once did. The raw materials needed to make steel are now more costly, and larger amounts of resources are found in other places. The steel industry also faces strong competition from steelmakers in other countries. In business, competition is the contest among companies to get the most customers or sell the most products. Partly because of this competition, steel mills in many cities have closed. Today, manufacturing is less important in Pennsylvania and in the other Middle Atlantic states than it once was. However, the Middle Atlantic states are still leaders in manufacturing. Now they use their resources to make not only steel, but also food products, chemicals, glass, electrical equipment, and machinery. Review. Why do Pennsylvania's steel mills now produce less steel? Lesson 3 review. Check understanding. 1. Remember the facts. How is an agricultural economy different from an industrial economy? 2. Recall the main idea. How have the Middle Atlantic states changed because of the ways that people have used resources? Think critically. 3. Think more about it. Without fertile farmland nearby, could the Northeast's coastal cities have grown as large as they are? Explain your answer. 4. Link to you. How have the jobs people do in your community or state changed over time? Show what you know. Writing activity. Write a paragraph or two telling how your life might be different today if the United States had not built an industrial economy.